You will know as well as I do that an entire media industry has grown up over recent years whose sole aim is to debunk myths. Not any myths, of course. Those specifically about the great and the good. And the greater and the gooder, the better. Oh, the glee with which heroes are stripped down and exposed, especially after they're dead and buried. How we love to hear of Mother Teresa doubting God's existence, or of John F. Kennedy's numerous affairs while in the White House. You can picture the Channel 4 documentaries now, can't you? You know, the real Mother Teresa, or the real JFK, or the real David Cameron. Except, I guess, for the simple fact that nowadays, tabloids don't even have the decency to wait until someone's buried. And we rightly associate this with the gutter press. Which makes 1 Kings 11 rather a shock. So we could call the chapter, give it the title, The Real King Solomon. And tabloid revelations are not exactly what you might expect when you open the Bible's pages. Chapters 1 to 10, the ones we've been looking at over the last few weeks, they've been wonderful, full of Solomon's great deeds and great moments. In fact, one could go so far as to say that the Bible's mountain peaks, some of the greatest mountain peaks in the Bible, are contained in those chapters. You know, think of Solomon's request for God's wisdom, or his building of God's temple in the city. And then, to top it all, the visit by a wowed African queen. I mean, in many ways, just turn back a page, would you, from our reading to page 349. In many ways, the Queen of Sheba's visit, as we were thinking about last week, was the Old Testament's Mount Everest. It never got better than this. You see, here, this pagan queen comes to Jerusalem. She sees it all, she hears it all, and what does she do? Well, look at verse 9 of chapter 10. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain righteousness, to justice and righteousness. So do you see? She gets it. Credit where credit's due. God is the one who did it all. And the rest of chapter 10, well, it outlines the fuller extent of the blessings that Solomon enjoyed. In fact, the splendor and diversity of his wealth, if you just take time just to read through the rest of chapter 10, it's breathtaking. In fact, it's almost obscene. But I guess there were people in the nation at the time who, well, they were quite impressed. They saw all this. They thought of their history, you know, their ancestry when they'd been a nation of slaves back in Egypt. But look at us now. You know, perhaps there's a sort of reflected glory. You know, our king can live like this. How great we must be. And of course, they didn't have the so-called benefits of tabloid press or investigative journalists to tear down the impression. But when we get to chapter 11, well, it's hard not to feel that the previous 10 chapters have frankly been a whitewash. Just as with JFK's Camelot, so Solomon's Jerusalem had a dark heart. It was the king's. And it gets exposed in the Bible, which demands the totally obvious question. What on earth went wrong? Now, I mean, how could the man who sought God's wisdom, and to top it all, was granted God's wisdom, how could this man end up like this? Well, as we begin in chapter 11, the excesses are obvious. We've had the wealth, the horses, the chariots, the jewels, and in our chapter, the women. Around 1,000 of them. I mean, that's enough to make your head turn. What's going on here? I mean, the real King Solomon sounds more like Hugh Hefner in his Playboy mansion than it does Churchill in the cabinet war rooms. What is this? Did it all go to his head? I mean, we're not dealing with minor aberrations or mere slip-ups here. This is a man who lived to excess. This is more Henry VIII than George VI. Now, you might be appalled by what Solomon got up to. And I think you would be right to be. But as we've already seen in this short series, Old Testament narrative can be frustratingly quiet, can't it? Frustratingly silent. Surely we expect, surely it must condemn the king's promiscuity and his acquisitiveness. Well, the interesting thing is it doesn't need to. Because it already had Old Testament law to provide a background commentary to all that we read, as we will go on to see. The writer just tells it how it is, tells us what happens, and leaves us to draw our own conclusions, but it's pretty obvious which conclusions to draw. But just notice, you see, at the end of the chapter, verse 41, you notice how, you know, the writer wraps up Solomon's life at the end, and he talks about the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did and the wisdom he displayed. Are they not written in the book of the annals of Solomon? In other words, if you want a full and detailed account of what happened during these years of Solomon's reign, well, go no further than the annals. Go to those other books, go down to your library, get them off the shelf, and you can read about those yourself. That's not this book. 1 Kings is not that. This is different. What he's doing here is writing a sort of end-of-reign report or a post-match analysis. And above all, you see, the writer is wanting to explain and to expose why it was that the nation fell so low after Solomon died. He's teaching us from the lessons of a history of failure. Because certainly we're not meant to be impressed by Solomon now. Far from it. We're not to take him as a moral example to follow. This is certainly not a mandate for polygamy. But we see how one man can profoundly influence and shape the life of the whole nation. We can see what difference a leader can make and whether or not we are in such positions of leadership, and I guess most of us are not. We can still learn lessons from our own life, from what happened to his. And I think there are two key things to notice that we can draw out from this chapter. The first one I'm going to bring out is much longer than the second, so don't panic. But there are two aspects of this God-given expose. One hidden, the other's not so. But please, don't for a minute imagine that this is tabloid gossip or revisionism. This assesses Solomon's regime from heaven's perspective. And as so often, God's view is so different from the world's. So what's the first point? The hidden sign of failure. Well, surprisingly, it's a drifting heart. I wonder if you remember from when we started this series, if you were here, when we began with Solomon's reign, and the words of his dying father, King David, as he spoke to his son, preparing him for what was ahead. You know, pretty important things. Don't bother looking it up. Let me just read to you. This is what David, as he died, said to his son, "Observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways. Keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements, as is written in the law of Moses." You'd think those words would echo in his mind, wouldn't you? Now, why did David say that to his son? Well, if Solomon did this, you see, it would have been impossible to avoid every king's set text, if you can put it like that. In fact, what we find in the law, in Moses' books, is a bit like a sort of parliamentary code of conduct from the Standards Committee, with the big difference that this is God himself telling his king how to behave, which definitely gives it much more teeth than the Parliament Standards Committee. Let's put it up on the screen. This is from Deuteronomy. This is what Moses said. The king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he's to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are the Levites. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. Does that ring any bells? It's pretty explicit, isn't it, about wealth and wives for one. I guess perhaps Solomon justified it to many of his marriages, I guess, as sort of essential ingredients to form and cement political alliances. Every culture has done that. Still happens. And that explains in chapter 11 that list in verse 1 of the different nations. And if you are at all familiar with Old Testament history, you'll know that some of these guys have reputations. At different times, they were all Israel's sworn enemies. But look what Solomon's doing. He clearly thought that he could keep his enemies at bay by the odd judicious wedding. You know, a royal wedding always goes down well, doesn't it? And oh, the irony. He marries Pharaoh's daughter. He goes back to Egypt. I mean, you know, Moses had warned not going back to Egypt to get more horses. He goes back to Egypt to get another wife. His losses, though, were far greater than his gains. Look at verse 2. You see, this time it's quoting from another part of the books of Moses. It's actually from both Deuteronomy and Exodus this time. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. There's that phrase again. Now, if the king is doing this, what hope do the people have? But please understand that this law is not about racism or discrimination. This is protecting the loyalties of the heart. But look how it continues, you see, because what we find is that for Solomon, this is not just about politics. Look how it goes on. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. Now, do you hear the defiance in that? He heard the word. He knew what God had said, but nevertheless, he held fast to them. Isn't that precisely what Moses had warned about would happen back in Deuteronomy? 1 Kings, you see, the writer deliberately uses the words, the language of the law, the language of hearts being led astray. So how could this happen? The king. Well, for one thing, no one seems to have stood up to him. Now, where were the Nathans of Solomon's generation? Nathan, do you remember, with knocking knees, had walked straight in to David's study and said, you are that man, and challenged him. And David repented in the words of Psalm 51 we used earlier. Nathan had done that at great cost. Everybody could see the numbers of wives that Solomon had. They must have thought something funny was going on. They'd read their Bibles. Where were the people who were going to speak truth to power? It's hard to do, though, isn't it? When he was the premier of the USSR, Nikita Khrushchev made massive reforms. He denounced many of the policies and the atrocities of his predecessor, Stalin. And at one public meeting, as he did a number of times, he censured Stalin. And as he was doing so, Khrushchev was interrupted by a heckler somewhere in the audience who shouted out, you are one of Stalin's colleagues. Why didn't you stop him? Who said that? Roared Khrushchev. There followed an agonizing silence. Nobody in the room dared move a muscle. Then Khrushchev replied quietly, now you know why. Speaking truth to power is hard. So who knows, perhaps Solomon had become the unaccountable dictator. It had gone to his head. It's not hard to see why. But that is still never an excuse for a powerful man, let alone God's king. It is never a defense to say, sorry, but nobody stopped me. And even if there was no one to hold him back, well, Solomon should have obeyed both Moses and his dad by putting God first, by reading and following his word. But he didn't. Notice how 1 Kings describes it there in verse 4. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. I mean, that's significant, isn't it? Solomon went through the motions, I'm sure. He went to the temple, he said his prayers, he made his sacrifices, he did his duty. But he didn't give his heart. His head was turned, his mind distracted, his heart astray. Remember, the Hebrew idea, the concept for heart, means your whole person, your will, your thoughts, your attitudes, your loves. God was no longer Solomon's. And who knows? I don't know, he could have justified it in all kinds of ways. Perhaps he justified the foreign gods. A simple, I don't know, cultural sensitivity to his wives, wanting to make them feel at home in a foreign land. Very sensible. But in time, you see, he wasn't just being sensitive. He was being immersed. The classic slippery slope. Look in verse 5. Ashtoreth was a fertility god. Her worship involves some less than godly practices in the temples. And then there's Molech, and in verse 7, Chemosh. And what's the big deal with them? What made them, well, it's strong language, isn't it? They're described as detestable. Well, it's simple. You worship those gods by sacrificing babies. Was that really allowed to go on under Solomon's watch? Oh, it's cultural sensitive. Just trying to make the wives feel at home. Again, you see, this is not a minor aberration. This is full-blown and utterly repugnant rebellion. This is a rejection of the God of grace and righteousness. Now, the Queen of Sheba, she's seen it. She'd come and praise Yahweh for all of that. She got it. Solomon forgot it. No wonder the verdict, verse 6. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. Now if you read through the whole of the rest of 1 and 2 Kings, that little phrase will repeat itself rather too often. Did evil in the eyes of the Lord. It's sort of shorthand. It has a very specific meaning in the book of Kings. It means turning to other gods. But here it has an added poignancy. Look at verse 9. One of you noticed this as Jonathan read it. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel. Look, who had appeared to him twice. It's chilling, isn't it? I mean, what does it show? It shows at the very least you can have all the blessings of the world. That you can enjoy even God-given wisdom. That you can have the sort of power and influence that most of us only dream of. That you can even have two encounters. Two one-on-ones with the living God. And still end in disaster. I guess we're not really surprised by that. I mean, we all know, don't we? We've read our tabloid exposés that tell us never to trust the spin about our leaders. But actually, I think there's a warning here to be wary of believing our own spin, the propaganda we put out about ourselves. Perhaps we rely on the fact that we made a good start in the Christian life and it was great at the beginning. And it's a thrill to be here with Mark having his baptism as he sort of publicly declares the beginning of his Christian life. We do perhaps look back to great moments. But that was just the beginning. What next? It's those little decisions that have a habit of determining the bigger decisions later on, isn't it? Without realizing it, we can start drifting. We start being just a little bit less passionate, just a little bit less wholehearted, just a little bit more compromised. Nothing big, nothing noticeable necessarily, except to ourselves, if we're honest. Now, C.S. Lewis, as ever, put it brilliantly. This is from Mere Christianity. Every time you make a choice, you're turning the central part of you, the part of you that chooses, into something a little different from what it was before. And taking your life as a whole, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning the central thing either into a heaven creature or into a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else into one that is in a state of war and hatred with God and with its fellow creatures and with itself. To be the one kind of creature is heaven. That is, it is joy and peace and knowledge and power. To be the other means madness, horror, idiocy, rage, impotence, and eternal loneliness. Each of us, at each moment, is progressing to the one state or the other. So those small decisions that turn our lives, they're so key. the decision of what I decide to do this minute, this day. What I decide to love. Who I decide to love. And what about those I decide to allow to get close? What about those I allow to ask me personal questions? Or do I rise above those who might challenge me? If it can happen to Solomon, my friends, it can happen to anyone. It can happen to me. It can happen to you. It's so subtle. It's so easy. Have no illusions. I would guess that most people sitting here are very unlikely to join the ranks of Richard Dawkins' New Atheists. Maybe there'll be a few. But most people are not in danger of that, I don't think. But most of us will soften here or there. We'll find little ways to dilute our devotion to God, whatever it might be, perhaps a willingness to compromise a little bit on Jesus' uniqueness, or to keep our heads down in an awkward moment at work. And it'll be slow, and it'll be imperceptible, but that's the nature of drift, isn't it? I mean, just think of a small boat moored in a harbour on a calm sea. Perhaps the anchors just come loose and the moorings start loosening up slowly. It starts inching out, but, you know, to begin with, you don't notice it. Just the sort of gentle chopping of the waves. 5 minutes later, you look up and the boat, yeah, it's sort of pretty much there. It's just slightly different position, but that's the way the wind and the waves work. Look up an hour later, it's almost over the horizon. You see, the Christian life is a marathon, not a sprint. And whatever age we are, we must take this to heart, especially if we're in the later years of life. The Bible is full of warnings about forsaking your first love and of growing out of your initial zeal. But our love for Jesus should not decline with age. By rights, it should grow. Isn't that why Paul writes to the Philippians in Philippians 3? He said these wonderful words, I press on to take hold of Christ. His energy there. Christ is his focus, the center of his vision. If only Solomon had kept his eyes fixed on Yahweh, as Moses and David had instructed him to do. It's not that he would have become perfect. No, of course not. His father David certainly wasn't perfect. It's just that he knew what to do when he fell. He came straight back to God. He didn't fall further away. He didn't run. He came straight back to his forgiving God. You see, Solomon, it seemed, stopped doing that, if he ever did it at all. That's why we read the scriptures. That's why we pray. That's why we keep asking ourselves questions. That's why we allow others to ask us questions. We do that when we're young, when we're middle-aged, and especially when we're old. You see, the temptations may be different at each stage in life, but I tell you, they are temptations nonetheless. So, very much more briefly, we see what happens in the rest of the chapter. The drifting heart leads to visible signs of failure, a crumbling kingdom. What's amazing is that God's still at work here. Even if Solomon has stopped trusting him, God is at work, but he's doing some pretty disturbing things. He's actually raising up people to destabilize the kingdom. But you see, the king's heart has gone astray. No one could see his heart, but God could. But the visible signs are there. One of the reasons I love architecture and love looking at buildings and learning about buildings is that they tell us a lot about both the people who build them and those who use them. And a city's buildings indicate a great deal about what matters to that city. So you walk around the old city of London, the square mile, and look at the medieval buildings that are still around. They're nearly all churches. Walk around the same area today, and all the contemporary buildings are investment banks. Well, Solomon's Jerusalem would have also been very notable for interesting buildings. I mean, the most dominant, the most wonderful and inspiring would, of course, been the temple on the Mount Zion where everybody could see. But there was also Solomon's palace in all that splendor. That was pretty revealing. But as his reign went on, there were other little construction sites around the city and outside. Little chapels. Not to Yahweh, but to Molech, and Chemosh, and Ashtra, and many others. Little chapels with all the business that went on inside. And that combination said it all. And God's judgment is clear. He says in verse 11 that he'd tear the kingdom away from Solomon while at the same time remain faithful to the promises to David about Jerusalem and his throne. So for the rest of the chapter, we grasp the wider political situation. There were enemies without. There was this guy Hadad, the Edomite from verses 14 onwards, and Rezon, the Aramite from verse 23 onwards, the enemies without. They agitated and caused trouble. There's actually even a little irony there that's easy to miss. Just look in verses 19 and 20, see who Hadad's wife was. Yet another political marriage. But look, Solomon had married one of Pharaoh's daughters. Hadad married Pharaoh's sister. So the Egyptian king was playing a double game, wasn't he? He was playing them off each other. Two sworn enemies, sort of brothers-in-law or in-law. Shows how pointless these dynastic marriages really were, doesn't it? But worse were the enemies within. The rest of the chapter describes this guy Jeroboam. He'd been a faithful servant of the king. He'd been a reliable fellow. Solomon entrusted him with all authority and power. But then he encounters the prophet Ahijah. No prophet from God could get close to Solomon. So God sends a prophet to get close to somebody else. This time his successor. And this very strange active parable of his cloak being torn up in 12 bits. And the meaning's clear. The nation will be split. With 10 tribes. 10! Going to the northern kingdom, breaking away from Judah in the south. Judah only got one other. Completely surrounded and outnumbered. It's amazing that God doesn't go the whole hog. But he says in verse 36, do you see that? I'll give one tribe to his son so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name, the city where the temple is built. And then verse 39, I will humble David's descendants because of this. But not forever. God will be faithful to his promises, even if his people are not. It's just so tragic. So unnecessary. Especially as it's because one man allowed his heart to drift. It seems extraordinary that it should infect and impact the whole nation. And there are big mysteries about this story. To my mind, the thing I've been scratching my head and I can't get my head around at all is how the man who has granted God's wisdom ended up such a fool. I don't understand that. But what we can see is this, that God's wisdom is greater than man's, and that within his purposes, through the southern kingdom of Judah, one in the line of David and Solomon will be born centuries later, one greater than Solomon. Because that king, Jesus, would never drift. He was never anything less than 100% fully devoted to God. His heart was never astray. Jesus, the king, was faithful where his people and his predecessors were not. Which is all the more reason to trust him, don't you think? He did what we couldn't. But perhaps as I finish, perhaps you're worried. Perhaps you're thinking that you're in danger of drifting. You think of those little decisions, perhaps in the last days or week. Those little decisions, you look back and think, didn't quite go right there. Does that set me on the wrong path? Am I doomed? Well, can I tell you, if that's what you're thinking, then you are in a much safer place than if you're not worried at all. You are much more likely to seek help, and help is at hand, because the wonder of the Christian gospel is that we are not enslaved to our history. We are not slaves, necessarily, of the decisions we've made, if we come to the God of history and the Lord of grace and forgiveness. And new starts. You see, King David, let's face it, King David had his own faithfulness issues, didn't he? Especially when it came to beautiful women. But when confronted, he did the only thing he could, the only wise thing he could, because unlike his son, he turned back to God and trusted him to forgive and rescue. So remember that phrase from Philippians 3? Remember how it goes on? I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. I'm his, he's got me. We take hold of him because he's taken hold of us. So do you see the even more the folly of turning to other gods, other ideologies, other isms, even other people, even people we love? Only one can break the chains of history. And that's the point of these warnings. That's one reason why we have Advent at all. To remind us, yes, this king is on his way back. He's coming back. And he yearns for his people to be ready for him, to welcome him with open arms, not to scurry into the shadows out of shame. We see our own frailties and the sheer stupidity of trusting ourselves, the sheer stupidity of trusting anyone other than the Lord Jesus. So this Advent, this Christmas, this life, whatever age we are, let us press on. Press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of us. Amen.